Cultivated Being Podcast. The Cultivated Being. Today on The Cultivated Being, two brothers are going to talk on a weekly chat about life, health, happiness, good stuff. And we are here right now. Please welcome your host, Dr. Jake Hyde.
It's me. I'm here with my brother, Dr. Nick Hyde.
Hey, everyone.
Nick, great intro. I thought you were going somewhere different with it for a second, but then I was like, nope, that's what we talk about every week. Pretty good.
You know, honestly, after we do every intro, I kind of have this moment where I get nervous. I'm like, did I press the record button? Or are we going to have to do this again? But no, it's going. We've got the momentum. We pressed it.
Good.
So
yeah, let's not lose momentum.
Nick, what's up?
It's casual Friday.
It's casual Friday. Yeah, we're both wearing t-shirts right now. I just got off a flight and
I'm just a slob. So I dress.
Your hair looks amazing. It's got a nice poof going.
Got the bouffant. Got a little lift in my hair.
Yeah, it's good. So, got lots of things we can cover today. Just good. As the nature of it, how it always is. Jake and I do not really talk about what we're going to talk about in the pod. And actually, Jake never tells me. So here we are. I don't know if he's got something special planned, but there's definitely lots of things to say.
Our pre-meeting goes like, hey, how's it going? We catch up a little bit. And then it's like, you have something to talk about? And then I go, yep, press record. And that's basically it. But this time I was like, Nick, I don't really have anything. You go for it. But then we just started talking about some crazy space stuff for a bit before we press record.
We really did talk about some crazy space stuff.
Nick, I have an interesting concept to think about cool. Space stuff. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to make it personal. I'm going to relate it to the heart.
Okay.
I just think it's very interesting how the atomic chart formed, essentially. Like, everyone remembers their atomic, like the table. What's that called?
Atomic table of elements?
That's the one I was thinking of. And there's all those elements on there. And I'm just thinking, you know, science has done a pretty good job of explaining, or I should say not explaining, but guessing how it all happened. Like, how did we go from, let's say, the origin of the universe, which we think was like 13.6, 13.8, 14.8? How old? How many billions of years do we think the universe is?
I thought it was 14.8 billion, but...
Yeah, so roughly 15 billion. So say it's 14.8. And for a long time, it was just like energy and gas, right? There wasn't really matter. But then there was some tons of like helium and hydrogen and things like that, like lighter molecules. But then you get all these metals, right? And our Earth is very dependent on metals. And I was thinking about one in particular, Nick. I was thinking about iron.
Okay.
And just because, you know, I had an anemic patient, which just means like they need more iron. And why do we need iron, Nick? Why is it so vital?
Well, it is an essential part. It's the first of all, it helps to color our blood red. Obviously, it's an integral part of our blood, and it helps the heme groups to get more oxygen.
Yeah, that was more detail than I was thinking you'd say. But yeah, it's really about oxygen needs a place to go in your blood cell, in your red blood cell, to be carried. And you need oxygen for energy. So iron plays this vital role in our like energy transport supply and like carrying energy to your tissues, right? So blood brings these raw nutrients throughout your body. Iron plays a vital role in allowing blood to carry oxygen, and we need oxygen to live. And iron was formed in just supermassive stars. like a ton of violence, a ton of energy, bringing matter together to form something dense like iron. And it happened way out in outer space. And somehow it's in our bloodstream. It's pretty crazy.
Well, yeah. You know, it's interesting, but stars are constantly fusing lower elements from the periodic table of elements. So when we think of a hydrogen bomb or a fusion reaction, which is way more powerful than just the regular nuclear bomb, I think it's actually like 100,000 times more powerful. So a nuclear bomb, you split atoms and it causes this huge reaction. With fusion, you combine atoms and it causes an even bigger reaction. Really cool. Now, that's what's happening in the sun right now. It's converting hydrogen to helium. And so there's all this fusion happening, and that's what the whole sun is all about right now.
That's the heat that we're getting right now. Comes from those chemical reactions, those atomic reactions.
Exactly. And a star somewhere right now is basically fusing one element that I'm not sure is, which is half of iron. It's fusing it to make iron. So some star is producing iron right now. Now, the thing is, it happens super quickly because when it gets to that stage, the sun isn't stable, or the star isn't stable anymore. And so it just immediately starts to just fuse and fuse and fuse, and it explodes. So usually all the heavy metals come from like an actual supernova happening. Like the minutes leading up to a supernova, you're getting all of these elements fused to huge, huge metals and even crazier stuff like uranium, right? You get these huge fusion reactions happening, producing all the metals we have.
Gold.
Exactly.
And gold's like twice as dense as iron, right?
Off the top
of my head. I think it roughly is.
I mean, I've never really experienced gold in my life. I've never had an experience of gold. But I hear it's way heavier than what the movies make it look like.
Yeah, because I think it's roughly twice as dense as iron. And I've held an iron brick. So the shape of something like in a movie where you see like a gold brick, it was that with iron, and it was like 30 something pounds.
Yeah.
Pretty stinking heavy. And gold's like roughly twice as heavy. So like a brick of gold could weigh like 70 pounds.
So if you have 12 bricks in a suitcase,
let's go and say 3 bricks in a suitcase.
Yeah. That's impossibly heavy to carry.
Yeah.
Well, anyways, as Jake and I speculate about this, probably losing a couple listeners. But
hey, you know what? I just wanted to relate it to the heart. Like, I just feel like the really woo-woo hippie people are like, they feel very connected to the stars and what the stars are doing and where they're configuring and whether they're retrograding or whether they're moving towards. It's like people get affected, and they can get affected emotionally. I'm just thinking something very basically scientific is like, yeah, just like the iron, just one element that is very vital to functioning in the body is like the stars made that.
It is incredible when you think about it.
And then like got super massive and dense and exploded and like created like quasars that just shot energy and matter across the universe. And like our hearts work now.
It's crazy.
Pretty wild.
Yeah. Well, speaking of hearts and blood, actually, I want to get into this, but maybe I'm not going to put Jake on the spot here. Maybe you've heard of phase four water.
I have.
I think this would be interesting to talk about because this kind of blew my mind. It's something I was learning about this week, but phase four water. So everyone kind of knows the three phases of water as in like liquid, gas, and solid. But there's a phase four, and it really exists within your body more than anywhere else, I think. And it's more of like a gel.
Yeah, it's like a plasma almost.
Yeah.
I think of it as like jello though in your cells.
It's in and around your cells, it's in your blood. and it's super healthy. So basically, if like you were looking at it under a microscope, it's basically water that looks like it's honeycombed itself together. It's like a bunch of water molecules in a way that's like, you know, hydrogen bonding and all other kinds of stuff. Now, the reason it's super important because it actually protects your arteries. Because in phase four water, there's what's called exclusion zones. And so basically like a honeycomb builds around stuff floating in the blood. You know, we're mostly water. So if you have this phase four water, all of this gel starts to flow through. I mean, if you think about it like this, we have like gel flowing through the tube. That's way more protective to our arteries than like, you know, just a totally liquid with all kinds of toxins or, you know.
Okay. Yeah. Well, think about this. Your shower drain is clogged. Water is not really even flowing through, but you squirt a little liquid plumber, which is gel. It's not liquid. Cleans it right out.
Totally. And so, yeah, it's obviously super protective, but you know, it is kind of like, yeah, grabbing, clumping and taking a lot of that, those toxins and things that we don't want to just be like scraping against our artery walls and capillary walls and everything. I think that's super fascinating. But
now,
yes,
Nick, because I know people sell phase four water, but does it not exist in nature? But do when we consume it, does it change from phase four down to liquid again? Because it's in like plant cell walls too, isn't it? It's like in...
Yeah, yeah, that's true. I'm sure, yeah, when you eat plants and stuff, you're probably consuming some of that.
Like, I think this is speculative, listeners. Don't take my word for this. But like juicing, right? So juicing, when you juice fruits and vegetables, like you're drinking a lot of water, but it's water that carries a lot of the nature of the, these things that you're juicing. I think, for example, and I think this is an argument I've heard and I haven't fact checked it, but there's different types of juicing. There's the kind that like just blend and filter. They have like the blades that just like tear up whatever. And then like centrifugal force,
centrifugal. I don't know.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Anyway, it like separates the liquids from the solids, right? And you get like a juice product. But the nature of that can change phase four water, this like gel-like structure, this honeycomb structure, into a regular liquid water. Whereas the cold press juices that just like squeeze your fruits and vegetables maintains some of that water and you consume it.
Yes, that is probably one of the best ways of consuming that. There's other things that I do want to talk about with that, but I want to talk about some heart issues. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of heart issues. People have heard of heart disease. We've talked about, you know, all kinds of things, blood pressure, occluded arteries, all kinds of stuff on the show. But we know that that's a serious issue. I think it's like the number one health crisis right now still in America.
Well, if you look at cause of deaths, heart disease is still number one.
And if you look at other kind of intimidating factoids, like the heart attacks, I was trying to think of the right one because there's a couple going on in my head, but like, the first heart attack people get, so this is like, they don't have a warning. Maybe they weren't checking with their health. Maybe they weren't going to their doctor and there was no warning sign. The first heart attack kills 40 to 60% of people.
Yeah. And I think what you were maybe thinking about saying was that the first symptom of that type of heart issue is a heart attack. So oftentimes the first physical symptom that they experience is a heart attack.
Yeah.
And that's just because your heart's really tough. Like it is gonna, it's just a workhorse. It's gonna keep doing its best until it can't no more.
Yeah, does an amazing job of it too. I mean, honestly, that's the last thing people really think about when it comes to their health, because they just take it for granted. I mean, I just figure my heart's going to beat a bunch of times this minute, and that's cool with it. It's good at it. It's been doing it forever. I could work out really hard, and I don't think, man, I might die right now.
Oh, yeah. I don't think that either. A lot of people actually get heart attacks kind of in a resting state, like on their couch though, too, you know?
A lot of them get it in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a lot that could be said. I was just thinking of a friend of a friend. They are this couple and they're just really connected, and they're definitely, there's lots of research coming out about whether or not people can read minds to some extent, like intuit what's going on. But this woman I know of, she golfs every day right now in her retirement. She golfs every day, 18 holes. And a couple of years ago, she's with friends, she's golfing, and halfway through, or maybe not even halfway through, she's like, I'm not feeling good. I've got to leave. And they're like, you know, are you sick or something? She's like, no, not sick, but she's just like, I have to leave. I have to go home right now. And right when she got home, she found her husband just starting to have a heart attack. And they're, you know, and so like, she's never changed that routine. She golfs every day, 18 holes. And for some reason that day, she's like, I just have to get home. And she got there right when her husband was having a heart attack and saved his life. He's totally fine. I think that stuff is really mind blowing. I just wanted to like plug that in for a second, but I want to continue going about heart stuff because there's lots of really cool things I think we could talk about as we go with this.
I want to go with psychic stuff.
Well, I think I could look for an article if you talk for a second.
I do want to talk. So one of my favorite researchers, you know, Nick, you don't have to ask me to talk, talk whatever. So one of my favorite internet lecturers is Rupert Sheldrake. He's awesome. Every time I listen to him, I feel so smart. He's one of those just like voices that's like, yep, I'm getting so smart listening to this. But he's super ostracized by a lot of like mainstream scientific people. And that's because he explores some of the deeper questions. Some questions like, do we even know what gravity is? Are we right about that? We might not be. Do you know we standardized gravity in like the 70s because it kept changing? So people around the world in different labs are like measuring the force of gravity on the Earth, and it kept fluctuating. And gravity is supposed to be a constant. So they just standardized it and they stopped experimenting on it like in the 70s. Anyway, he asks good questions like that. He's curious about psychicness. He's done a lot of studies with like, are dogs psychic? And not like dogs are speaking to like your dead loved ones type of situation. They're just like, they can like sense when their masters are like a change in behavior or something like that, right? And there's a really cool, it's like super old. It was on like BBC like 20 or 30 years ago. And the interviewer and the film crew like takes the master out of the home and they're like running errands and they're doing stuff. And the dog is just sitting there being observed with cameras. And it's having its normal day. It's laying in its favorite place, just being very like docile. And then they have two cameras set up and they're cued to each other. At least that's what they say. They're cued to each other. And the person out with the master was like, should we go home? And the lady's like, yeah, let's go home. And like on cue, the dog just kind of came out of its nap and moved towards the door. Like at the same time. I was like, yeah, really, let's go home. And the dog was just like, kind of perked up. And then you saw the camera crew following the car too. And the dog was just like, got excited before he was even on the street. Like right around the corner, the dog was like wagging its tail. And I don't know if they filmed 100 of these and this is the one dog that like nailed it. Who knows? But an experiment that I think is really cool that Rupert Sheldrake's done a ton of and has other groups do it is like a very simple psychic test on whether you can sense you're being watched or not. Have we talked about this on the pod ever?
No.
Okay. This is very interesting because it's a simple test anyone can do at home. You have someone sitting, there's like the experimentee and the tester, okay? Just need two people. And one person is sitting facing away from the tester. They're the experimentee. And the tester either flips a coin, so it's random. It's not predictable, right? So you flip a coin, heads or tails. Say heads is you look at them, okay? So it's heads and you stare at them. And then you have some kind of audible cue so you don't have to talk because talking could give it away too. Just like a click, like a button or some kind of sound. And you hit the sound and that person says, looking or not looking. And you just keep track. And over time, the data should say nearly 50%, right? Because it's flip of a coin. Should be like that. But historically, it's not. Historically, it's of statistical significance that people can sense when they're being watched. And this makes sense in nature. If you could be hunted by some kind of predator, it makes sense that you would have developed a keen sense of, am I being watched? Mm. Now, this is where I think it gets really interesting. He was telling this story in an interview of early on in this concept, and he was testing it with his son, his oldest son. He was just like barely older than a toddler. And his kid guessed 20 for 20, right?
That's really cool.
Remarkable, right? That's cool by itself. He did it again, 20 for 20. And the kid was like loving it. He's like, this is great. And he's like, Dad, can you do it with me? And he's like, okay. So they switched roles and Rupert got like 11 or 12 out of 20, right? Which is pretty par for course.
Yeah.
And his son's like, well, why didn't you get it all right? And Rupert's like, I don't know. It's kind of hard. It's not that easy to do. And then his kid never got 20 for 20 again. The kid moved back to the norm. I think that's so interesting. So this kid had no reason to think that wasn't easy to like tell when like mom or dad was watching you, you know?
Yeah.
And then once the kid was like, oh, this is supposed to be hard, he probably second-guessed himself.
Yeah.
He probably thought, instead of feeling, that like sixth sense that we're talking about, it's that like keen subconscious sense that I'm being stared at. He second-guessed. He thought his way through it. And then he came back to like the norm, the statistical average.
That's pretty cool. You know, it kind of reminds me of my wife and I at one point. I like to show my nieces and nephews, basically, I like to try to prove to them over and over again that I'm like supernatural, indestructible, all kinds of stuff, just to play with their minds and see what they think. And also to just kind of believe in, you know, stuff bigger than what they're told. And this was a trick I came up with a couple of years ago. But I was like, you know, Nini, I call my wife, is called Nini for some reason, but her name is Claire. And I was like, you know,
it's your Nini, nickname, Nick.
Nick. I came in when they're already older, you know, so they didn't give me some cute nickname or anything. But so I told them, I was like, you know, Nini and I could read each other's minds. And they're like, what? I'm like, yeah, you want to see? And I was like, tell Nini a number 0 to 10 and, you know, I'll tell you what the number is. And of course she would either squeeze my hand or tap on my foot or something like that. And so we were getting them all right. I think we did it like 10 times and every time they're like, no way, you know, that's crazy. And then of course, you know, the older kid comes and it's like, there's some trick happening here. Mm-hmm. And so she's like watching everything about us as we do this. Mm-hmm. And we're just trying to, you know, come up with other tricks. We were trying to be more clever. I don't know how we hit it and all those middle things, but we were hiding other ways of doing it. And then they really got clever and like, they all were like, okay, you have to move apart and like all these things. And now there's like five of them and they're all watching everything we do. And I'm like, okay, this is getting complicated. I don't know if I want to do this anymore. But I let them do it three more times without the aid of being able to do anything. Mm-hmm. And we still got the numbers exactly right. And I was getting freaked out about it. I was like, wait a minute, can we read each other's minds? But yeah, that blew the kids' brains for sure. But in this paper, this new study that was done relatively recently, last year, 2019, published in the Journal of Neuroscience, which is a very big, important,
it's a good journal.
Yeah. They did this thing where there was three people hooked up with electroencephalographs, EEGs, which is basically like electrodes on the brain. And I don't know exactly the pattern they did it, whatever. And these three people were in different rooms, but the wiring went to all three. Two of those people were shown how to do a task. And the task would be something like there'd be like four blocks on the table or whatever. And the people would come into these two people and say, okay, this is how I want the blocks to be arranged. And then they'd leave. Now the third person didn't know, but with these electrographs in different rooms, they would think about this person solving it step by step, how to arrange these blocks. And the third person would have no instruction of how to arrange the blocks. And that third person would do it majority of the time, exactly how the other two were instructed. So does that make sense for everybody? There's three different rooms.
Well, it makes sense for me.
Three different rooms. They're all hooked up with this, you know, basically electrodes on the brain. They're not communicating verbally. They're in different rooms. Two people know how to put the blocks in a certain way. The third person has no clue. And the third person just sits there with these electrodes on the brain, and one block at a time, you know, these two other people are like, move the block this way in their brain, and the third person would do it. So,
okay, this gets into another idea presented by Rupert Sheldrake decades ago called morphogenic fields. So that information on like-minded species gets stored in more of a field state that they have access to, and there's information. So how this first came about, you have something to say?
Well,
about morphogenic fields.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about this on several episodes before, but this is a good time to talk about, because it's always fun to talk about.
It is fun to talk about. So how this kind of came about was they were studying epigenetics, actually, which is epigenetics is the study about how your environment and your experiences interact with your DNA. And then like also what can get passed down generations, like what experientially, like trauma can get passed down. And it does make sense in nature, like to have a collective wisdom that's inherited. That's how animals that are typically prey kind of have a built-in understanding of like what to look out for and what to be cautious of. Right? Kind of like a collective trauma for survival. But anyway, they were studying this. And so they had clones of rats. So these are all the same, not just species, but like identical rats. And they would do like a complicated maze. So kind of the same thing you do this experiment with humans. And then they're offspring, the next generation would do it, and they would do it on average significantly faster. And the third generation, even faster on average. Okay. And they don't interact like mom and kid. They didn't get to teach each other anything. It's just like the next generation just was more advanced in this particular maze, not mazes as a whole. This is like the same maze. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So cool study. We're like, wow, that seems to like prove epigenetics, you know? So what they did was they took the same lab, all these on the same like lab mice or rat, and these all have like particular names of like created bred labs. They took the same ones and they tried them in different labs around the world. And the first generation in these different labs was already more advanced, like more on cue with the third generation at the initial one. And that was happening in all the labs. So they were meaning to study epigenetics, like inheriting, like offspring inheriting some information or intelligence from their parents. But this wasn't from parents. It's just the species got better at this particular maze all across the world. And then this kind of, I don't know if this bred into this concept or maybe it supported this idea of morphogenic fields, like having access to an intelligence or information from similar types of species.
Yeah. I mean, I love this, you know, something I've talked about in the past. There is a study similarly that was done with this species of monkey on these islands, and they, a researcher showed a monkey how to like find that there is these root vegetables and like yams underground.
Oh, I had to like dig them up with the tool.
Yeah. Like how to dig them up and eat them. And they, one of them, they observed that they taught this one, and this one would come back the next day and was like, okay, I found an awesome supply of food, and would do it and eat their food. And then eventually all of the young generation would do it. Now the old generation didn't really learn it quite as well. And even when the researchers would give them the yam, like they didn't like it as much. They didn't have like a taste for it as much. They didn't like it as much. And they're just like, this is really interesting. But like they were doing this research, and then all of a sudden they noticed, like one day it happened where now all of the young monkeys were doing this. Like every single one of them, just like overnight, was like, learned how to do this. And they couldn't even believe it. So they're like, let's do this again. And so they go over to like this next island. They're going to repeat the experiment. And the monkeys were already doing it. And they're like, wait a minute, what's going on? So I thought that was really cool. Oh, but yeah, M fields, it's super interesting. And you can think about it too. Like I've observed this with, you know, it's easy to observe this with animals that aren't like super smart because they don't learn the way that we do. They're just so instinctual. But I've noticed this, like there's certain areas of the world where you go, for instance, the Grand Canyon, and squirrels act super differently there.
Oh, they are not afraid of humans at all.
They are not afraid of humans at all. And do you think they all had to like learn that over time, that like humans weren't a threat? No, it's like they just all of a sudden they're just like, that's what we're gonna do as locally, that's what our species is gonna do. They just learned it, you know.
They've learned to be kind of dependent on humans for sustenance, so it's like we're an important part of their, like I don't know how much they do like foraging for nuts. It's just like, to the humans, be cute and they'll give you food.
Yeah.
And it works.
Yeah.
They're so cute.
And if we knew like everything about frequency and the way energy moves, we'd probably be like, oh, you know, we call it an M field, but it's like this frequency that all squirrels have receptors to, and the frequency updated and changed and they evolved to that or whatever. We just maybe haven't completely discovered the science behind all that, but it's observable a million times over. I do think it's like, I don't know. I think we've mentioned this before, but with tuning forks, like if you have two tuning forks in the same room and that are at the same frequency, you could ring one and the other will start vibrating because it's the same frequency. Like you didn't have to touch it. You didn't have to ring it. You didn't have to do anything. You just hit the one and the other will start vibrating.
Yeah. And same with instruments that are tuned to each other. So like a guitar string, you and I have guitars that are tuned. and I pluck the A string, yours will start vibrating.
And that's like true with us humans as well. I mean, we are constantly vibrating at different frequencies. This is like all quantum physics too. I mean, and it is interesting to think about the applications of that one thought, how we might, for instance, as an example, like if someone comes into this room right now who's experiencing grief and is at that energy of grief, I might start to vibrate, especially if I have unresolved grief or I'm like, whatever, I might start to vibrate in that grief mode and be experiencing grief myself.
If you're already like calibrated to it.
Yeah.
But same with like higher vibration emotions, right?
Totally.
Like joy. That person that comes into the room that can just elevate the whole room.
Yeah.
We all probably know a person like that, that just like elevates everything when they're present with you. Oh, and those same people that just like bring everything down too.
Well, and that's what, you know, this is why I used to love a lot of really heavy, maybe dark rock music. And I just can't really listen to it anymore. Like before, it used to feel like elevating. Like I would listen to, I don't know, I don't want to give an example because someone's going to be offended out there, but I used to listen to some kind of darker stuff. And to me, it felt like an emotional release. And I was like, yeah, I feel better. But now if I listen to that, it's like, whoa, I don't vibe with this at all anymore. And it feels down there to me now. It's not in a judgmental way at all. I mean, I still like the music. I would love to play drums along to it or guitar along to it, but it's just a different vibration.
Yep. I'm with you too. A lot of the stuff I was into, it's not that it's not good music. It's just emotionally connecting differently with me and it's less interesting. Mm-hmm. And it's still really good music.
Yeah. You know, it's one thing I did want to talk about. I just spent a week with a bunch of healers, health practitioners of all kinds. And I wanted to say, they're just like the best sorts of people.
Yeah. A kooky bunch, but so good. Yeah.
I mean, conspiracy theories going around being passed around in a room like that is pretty funny. But one thing that I've always loved is they just seem so non-judgmental about everything.
Yep. Yeah.
And that is cool. Talk about a cool M field.
Yeah, just like a receptivity to people and souls. It's so like warm and inviting.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, they're always trying to intuit and to help people. And I think that just plugs in. I think, you know, once you see every type of person, you only really learn to have compassion on every type of person.
Mm-hmm.
And that compassion, you know, does spill over to themselves usually in a lot of ways, but it just like, they just kind of stay in that state of compassion and they're just ready to listen and help and hold space for people and dealing with whatever, you know. It's like every time, I think early on when I would be around health professionals, I always thought that they were going to judge me for not being healthy enough.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Not like, it wasn't like to the point where I was avoiding them, but you know, like you have these moments where you almost want approval and validation, like you've been a good boy or something and you're doing all these things. And
but you're like deep down judging yourself for not being healthy enough. And you're like, these people are definitely going to judge me for not being healthy enough.
Totally. And the more I'm around these people and the more I see it just in myself, not that I'm even like that good at it, but with people who come into me and talk about anything and everything. And it's just like, I get it, you know, no judgment. There's just love and compassion for that. You're in a place and don't have any regret about it. You're here. If you would have done better, if you could have done better in the past, you would have. You're here right now. And this is where you're at. And there's no judgment on it. We have some choices we can make and there's a lesson of the moment and you'll continue to go to a better place if you're open to love. And if you're not open, you're not choosing the lesson of the moment and choosing to learn the lesson of the moment, like, you'll get more opportunities to learn it.
Absolutely. That's a beautiful idea, Nick.
It's not original.
No, but it's a beautiful idea. And it's something that needs to be reminded, because it's easy. I mean, it's so easy to be distracted. So much information coming at us. So many other things to think about that are far less important. So it may not be original, but we need constant reminders of what to prioritize.
Yeah. And yeah, it's easy to feel like you're stuck on a treadmill in the same place, and you're not, like, you're working, in other words, you're working really hard and you don't feel like you're getting anywhere.
Right.
And I think it's important to reflect on what themes have been coming up in your life, and maybe what you're holding on to. That's what attachments you have, what aversions you have. Jake and I talk about this all the time. That's stopping you from progressing. What are you afraid of? I think our ego, the scariest thing to our ego is fear of loss, because it can't do anything about it. It's the one thing it really has no control over. And so it's the most defensive and protective against loss. And to the point where, like, we will not move forward. I mean, think about Teresa of Avila says, any plateau you experience in your growth is because you're attached to something. You're attached to something at that level of what you're experiencing in your life. We don't have to be afraid of growth, because growth is always progression upward and inward to something better, because that's how we know the universe, the benevolent forces of the universe, which is God. That's how we know God to be. God is love. And we're always like, I don't want to grow because it means I'm going to have to, like, suffer and be destroyed and be persecuted and whatever, all these things. But that's just not how it works. It's like every choice to go further and higher means more relief. It means we let go of the things that cause us suffering. It's only freedom, you know?
I find that to be very interesting. Freedom is definitely a theme coming up this year in my practice and in my life. And very analytical, my inclination academically is like math and science. Like, I want rules. I want logic. I want something that's linear, you know? And I've typically applied that to my understanding of God, which means essentially I'm boxing God into my intellect. Like, God is as big as my capacity to rationally understand a thing. And I've known for a long time that's not true. And I'm becoming more like heart-centered. I'm becoming more like wisdom-centered versus knowledge-centered. And I'm appreciating the unknowing. I'm appreciating the contemplation of, like, small things. Like, wow, this, like, flower, this tree, this mountain, just like the magnificence of things that are on a smaller scale, but part of creation. And it's been really healthy for me, and it's been healthy for me to become less attached to what I know or what I can put into an equation, right? Which can be, like, solved. Mm. Like, that's why I like math and science, you know? It's just like, I used to get so frustrated with the other subjects in school because I loved math. It made sense to me. It was true. It's either true or not true, and math would confirm that. But, like, English, literature, any language class, history, didn't make any sense. There's no rationality behind those constructs, right? It's history. It doesn't make sense. It's like the story of human behavior. It's irrational. So I had a hard time with those subjects. Anyway, I start thinking about love more in like my contemplation and meditation. And it's this like force that we can connect to that defies logic and linear thinking. Seems to be like a portal to something more divine that we can share. We can interact. We can love our dog. We can love our partners. We can love our kids. But it's like, I think that's us like stepping into something that's both true and like undefinable.
Totally. Well, you know, I think it is, we do hold knowledge up on a pedestal and we think science can understand everything. But science can't understand, there's no math behind eternal, but we know philosophically that if there is a God, God would have to be eternal because that would be essential to God's nature. And so like already you're like, well, our human thought can't really rationalize and understand the big picture in these mm-hmm. ways. And, you know, eternal already means non-linear. That's exactly mm-hmm. what it means. Without time, there's no linear aspect to God. God is outside of linear. And so I think if you are in that place of, I need reason, I'm holding on to the payoff of reason. I feel like reason is the ultimate thing. Reason is really good, but it will only go so far. Faith is, you know, that's what I'm thinking of. Santa Claus, the Santa Claus with Tim Allen. And he's like talking with that little elf who made him hot chocolate. And he's like, I see this stuff, but I don't believe it. It's all fake. And she says, seeing isn't believing. Believing is seeing. I think I quote that movie too much, but I love that movie.
You know, when I contemplate the mysteries of the universe, I often go to Tim Allen as well.
Yeah, believing is seeing. I mean, we have to, if you want to surrender to God, you have to surrender to the idea that God is greater than thought.
Mm-hmm.
And that's super freeing. That's the joy. That's where freedom comes, because that is like, okay, sweet. I can let go of that.
Yeah. And so God is greater than thought, but is God greater than love? Arguably no, because he is love. No, Nick's wheels are turning.
Well, yeah, I think in the way that we're speaking about this, I don't know if that is a rule that would apply, because love is a quality of God. So God is essentially greater than love, because love is only one thing about God.
I don't know. It's quoted somewhere that God is love. I don't know who said that. Okay. But
yeah.
But certainly the way we experience love is filtered through our own limitations. So
totally.
God's probably greater than what we understand love to be, but not love in its pure essence. Because love in its pure essence, maybe that's what God is.
Yeah. I had a patient, I'm doing a house call to this one client, and she's bedridden. She can't move. She's mostly paralyzed. And she has this Where's Waldo, huge Where's Waldo poster above her bed. And I was thinking about it last time, because I heard from somewhere that you tend to find what you're looking for. Whatever you're looking for, you tend to find. And I was looking up at this for a second last time I was there. And if you're looking for a Waldo and a Where's Waldo, you see the colors of red and white everywhere. It's just like, you see it there and there and there, you know, like that's what you, if that's what you're looking for, you see it.
And like glasses.
Yeah. And if, for instance, too, like if you get a new car, all of a sudden you see that car everywhere.
Oh yeah. If you're shopping for one too, and you're like, oh, I think I might get a, you know, whatever car you think's kind of unique and interesting. And then it's like, it's pretty popular.
Totally. So the point I'm trying to make is if you're looking for love, if you're looking for joy, and not just like, I'm looking for a lesser definition of love, like pleasure or instant gratification or a quick fix, you're selling yourself short. If you're looking for real love or joy, you will tend to find it. You'll find it in all kinds of places. If love is your aim, you will see it everywhere.
Totally. I think about this analogy, which is super outdated now, but it's good. Or you be the judge of it. I think it's good.
Okay.
But there is, like, in my room right now is the signal, the frequencies for every radio station in the city of Nashville. It's in this room right now. But if I had a receiver, I can tune specifically to just one station and I can focus on that transmission, what's coming in. And my experience in this room would be the experience of that which I'm tuned to. Even though every station is in this room right now, every signal's in this room. So if I didn't like what I was experiencing, I can just turn the dial. See, it's pretty outdated, but I could just turn to a different signal and I'm experiencing something else. I just tune to a different frequency and then now that's what I'm experiencing. And I feel like that's that, great. Like emotionally, all of the signals are in this room right now with me. But it's like, what am I tuned to?
Totally. That is awesome. That is awesome. And no judgment on the lower signals. That might be where you're at right now.
Are you talking to me?
No, I'm saying for everybody.
That's true.
I'm saying for everybody. Yeah, it's like grief might be extremely empowering if you're coming from apathy or shame.
True.
And if now all of a sudden you're in tuned up to grief and you're seeing grief everywhere, every song sounds like it's sad or whatever, that might be a really good thing for you. There's no judgments on that. You know, like that is a healthy place to be at. But ultimately what we want to be in tune with is source. That's what this is all about. If you're tuned to source, which is God, the heartbeat of love and peace and joy in the universe, then you're unlimited. You're tapped into an eternal, not a finite source, an infinite source, right? And, you know, I'm watching this show, Messiah, and you know, the guy in it that the show is called Messiah about, he never says he's the Messiah, but what's so cool is he's so present in the moment in every scene that it almost sometimes seems like he doesn't care what's going to happen to him. Like he gets detained so many times in the show. I'm not going to spoil anything. He gets detained so many times in the show. It seems like he's constantly in a prison or someone else wants him or someone's going to kidnap him or whatever. And he seems to be totally unfazed by it because he's like, this is what is meant to happen for me. And good is going to be created from these circumstances every time. It's so cool.
All right, Nick.
That's what happens when you're, you know, connected with source. That should be the case for everybody.
Just like full trust. Yeah, that's what I want to be.
Me too.
All right. Well, my next client's here.
Okay.
Nick and I usually record at the end of the day for me, but Nick's a busy man these days. I got to get him when I can.
Not quite, but anyways, glad we were able to chat. Hopefully this was good for everybody.
Yeah, man.
Peace, everybody. Have another great week until next pod. And, peace and love to everyone.
All right. Love you, bro. Love you, everybody. All right. Bye.